This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. We acknowledge them as traditional owners and pay respects to elders past and present. Mike, what were you doing on the morning of February 10, 2015?
2015? Dale, I don't even remember what I was doing last week.
Well, it is a significant date because on that day, there was a huge Eurovision announcement.
Hello. Bonjour. Guten Tag. I'm Julia Zemiro, and I've got some very exciting news to share with you. This year at the Eurovision Song Contest in Vienna, Australia will be competing in the grand final.
Well, it was a monumental day for us fans because Australia was actually going to compete in the Eurovision Song Contest. I remember the day very well, waking up at like 6 a.m, scrolling through my phone and seeing that news. Like, I think I was screaming. I was definitely swearing and carrying on enough that my housemate came into my room and was like, "Are you okay? Is everything okay?"
Well, I don't think I was that emotional, Dale. To be honest, I think I was most excited that after all these years, I'll finally be able to get to vote.
Well, yeah, look, for us, we'd both been fans of the contest for decades, but Australia taking part, I think, really took our passion to another level.
Yeah, from being sort of casual fans of the contest, we went into overdrive. We went to Stockholm in 2016 and then started the Aussie Vision podcast the following year.
Yeah, we've been doing that podcast now for 7 years. We've been reporting on the ground over at the Eurovision Song Contest. And I think compared to 2015, we've become far more knowledgeable, I would say, about this crazy contest.
Some would question that possibly, Dale. But there is one question that we always get asked everywhere we go in the world.
Yes, and that is, why is Australia in Eurovision?
I think that is something every Australian Eurovision fan can relate to.
So over 3 episodes, we are going to try and answer that very question.
Yes, people, it's that complicated. It's going to take 3 episodes.
And to help us on this journey, we've spoken to people behind the scenes and making it all happen, as well as Eurovision artists and academics.
I'm Mike Jones.
I'm Dale Roberts.
And welcome to Why is Australia in Eurovision? Why, out of all countries outside of Europe, was Australia, a nation completely on the other side of the world, led into Eurovision?
Well, the announcement in 2015 didn't just drop out of the sky. There was a long build-up to get us to that point.
To understand how we got there and Australia's connection with Eurovision, we have to go back to just after the Second World War.
Coincidentally, that's around the same time the Eurovision Song Contest actually started. It was back in 1956.
To explain this better than we could, we spoke to an actual expert.
We spoke to Associate Professor Jess Carneal from the University of Southern Queensland up in Toowoomba. She is a Eurovision academic, especially when it comes to the multicultural connections in Australia.
After World War II, we saw mass migration from Europe because Europe itself was obviously war-torn, which had great economic impacts, and it meant that people were looking for opportunities elsewhere. Australia itself was looking for migrants to come over here because it also needed to rebuild, but not in that sort of war-torn way, in that understanding of the small population had left Australia incredibly vulnerable during the Second World War. So there's this cry to populate or perish and get more people in. There was also a kind of racial agenda at the time where Australia wanted to try and keep itself as white as possible. It wasn't entirely successful in doing that, but it did seek to keep itself as white as possible. So it looked to Europe predominantly to try and draw those migrants over here through various schemes where they were being sponsored to come over for work and so forth. So in that period, we saw large groups of migrants from the UK, but never to the numbers that Australia wanted because they were priority migrants, then from mainly Southern Europe and then other parts of Europe as well. And so that's how we have hundreds of thousands of migrants coming from those places to Australia and helping to construct what we now know as culturally diverse, multicultural Australia.
But Mike, even with all that mass migration to Australia at the time, the culture here was still very British, wasn't it?
Now, I don't want to age myself too badly here, Dale, but I remember we still sang God Save the Queen at school because it was officially our national anthem. Eventually, we did have to learn the new one.
I mean, that blows my mind that God Save the Queen was our anthem up until the 80s, actually. But that British identity is how Australia first made our mark on the Eurovision stage. During the 70s, many Aussie artists competed for the UK over there at the contest, and we had members in the New Seekers who finished runner-up back in 1972.
In 1974, the iconic Olivia Newton-John came fourth behind a little-known Swedish band called ABBA.
And the very next year, John Farrar, who's a very well-known person in the music industry in Australia, he was a member of The Shadows, and they finished runner-up at the song contest in 1975. So even in the 70s, Australia couldn't quite take the crown.
Also at the time, Eurovision music was very popular here in Australia. The likes of Brotherhood of Man and even songs like Eres Tu and Après Toi did really well in the charts here.
But even with all of that, the contest hadn't been broadcast in Australia. It didn't have a home here. But that was about to change with the setup of SBS. Here's Dr. Jess to talk us through it.
In 1978, there was a report known as the Gulbally Report. And what it did is have a look at what kinds of services were available to migrants in Australia and how to better support them with their settlement and integration. And one of the key things that that report identified was the importance of media in helping people to settle into Australia. So things like radio, television, and also representation was a huge part of that. So SBS as a radio station had already been functioning in the 1970s, but only in Sydney and Melbourne. But what happened with the Gulbally Report is that they expanded that into TV as well, establishing SBS TV as we know it today, and also had a plan to expand SBS services across Australia, although they didn't succeed in doing that until I think 1996 or the mid-90s was when they last managed to expand the television network.
Just a few years after launching, SBS began broadcasting the Eurovision Song Contest in 1983. Dr. Jess explains why it was a good fit.
When you think about it from the broadcaster's perspective, they're looking for bang for their buck. And when you look at something like Eurovision, even though it was a little bit smaller at that stage in terms of the number of broadcasters participating, it meant that you had multiple countries that migrants were from being represented in this one entity. So you broadcast that and you're ticking all sorts of boxes in allowing migrants to still feel connected to their homeland, but also provide really good entertainment.
Guten Abend and willkommen, good evening and welcome to Munich and the Eurovision Song Contest 1983. And welcome too to our viewers in Ireland and viewers by satellite in Australia.
Well, that clip was the iconic Terry Wogan giving a shout out to Australia in the first broadcast. Probably not surprising that we used the BBC commentary. And look, that was going to continue for decades to come for Australians.
Now, although I didn't quite catch the inaugural broadcast, it was only a few years later that I first saw the contest on SBS. Dale, I grew up in a very multicultural suburb in Melbourne, and the first time I saw Eurovision, I was at a Yugoslav friend's house. We were out and about kicking the football, came back inside, and his mum was sat there watching Eurovision. And I asked her, "What is this?" And she looked at me like I was some unwashed heathen and said, "It's the Eurovision Song Contest." She explained that each country would send a song and then they would all vote on the winner. Now, I was intrigued, so I sat down and started watching it. I have to say, I thought it was pretty naff, so we didn't quite get off on the right foot, me and Eurovision.
Some would still say you're a bit of an unwashed heathen, Michael. But look, although I didn't know what Eurovision was at this point in the 80s, I'm a little bit younger than you, there were certainly big acts that I was aware of, like Bucks Fizz and Johnny Logan, and they were really commercially successful here in Australia.
Yeah, Hold Me Now charted all over Europe and one other place, and you'll never guess where that was, Dale, Australia.
And Johnny Logan won the contest for Ireland twice as a singer and once as a writer. But he's also Australian. Well, he kind of is. He was born in Frankston, Victoria, so we do claim him as one of our own. He is incredibly important to Australia's Eurovision story. Here's Dr. Jess to explain why.
Because it gave us this point in time to say we already belong. And we also use that strategically with people like Olivia Newton-John and the New Seekers to say, hey, we've been participating in this for a while, just not under the Australian flag. And I think Johnny Logan is a particularly interesting character because even though he migrated back to Ireland, he was very, very young when he migrated back there, he did keep on returning to Australia. So there was always that lasting connection. And that was not just to visit family, but to actually do tours of his music.
There was another artist of the 20th century who was incredibly important to Australia's Eurovision story, and that is the legend that is Gina G.
Yes, the UK representative in 1996 with the worldwide hit and Grammy-nominated banger, Ooh Ah, Just a Little Bit.
She was really important for me in my Eurovision story. Now, I grew up in a country North Queensland, very different to you, Michael. I hadn't actually even heard of the Eurovision Song Contest. We didn't even get SBS where we were from, but I knew this song and I knew it was competing in this song contest. That's how I discovered it. And I think it really kind of matched what was happening with Australia at the time. During the 1990s, we were starting to hit big on the international stage. You know, we got the Olympics, we were winning Oscars, and then we had Gina G as well as part of that. And I do think there was that part of me that really thought like, wow, Australia's not such a kind of backwater anymore. We're actually out on the global stage and we're being noticed. So I really kind of saw Eurovision as a part of that for Australia to make a big mark on the international stage.
It was definitely a time when a sense of change was palpable in Australia, whether it was how we saw ourselves or our place in the world. This change was mirrored in what was happening at SBS.
SBS had been going under a bit of an evolution from the 1990s into the 2000s. And the way that I like to track this is by looking at their self-promos that they had. So those of us of a certain age may remember The World is an Amazing Place, which was late 80s, early 90s. And then we start to get into 6 Billion Stories and Counting, which was the early 2000s, I believe. And so what we have here is this kind of transition of the world being something that we kind of watch to the world being something that we connect with and understand. So that ties into the way that SBS starts to approach Eurovision and sees it as an opportunity. And part of the way that that opportunity starts to be nurtured is through putting our own stamp on it through the commentary. Because by that point, we had gotten quite a few fans watching Eurovision, and they weren't necessarily the people that a lot of us expect or stereotype as Eurovision fans at that time, because we expect them to be migrants. But in the 1990s, SBS had branded itself as a bit of a cult TV thing. So you had a wide range of people, usually hip young people, that are watching things like Eurovision and other kinds of cult movies. And that had developed this kind of cool following that was also about a cosmopolitan connection to the rest of the world. So Australia wanted to be part of that party. And by putting our own commentary on it, it was saying that, you know, this is not just something that we're importing and watching. This is something that we interact with as Australians.
Now, I think that really shows that SBS was really starting to try and Australianize their broadcast. They started experimenting with Australian presenters and commentators for what was being presented to the audience.
Shall we just say, with mixed results, maybe.
Yeah, we had the first commentator was a popular comedic Greek character of Effie the first year. And then we had Des Mangan, who was a prominent presenter on SBS already and a big Eurovision fan. Despite the efforts, fans weren't quite ready for that change.
So SBS went back to the steady hand of Terry Wogan.
But even though SBS didn't Australianize the contest, it actually grew in mass popularity through the 2000s. It had a real cult love about it.
Yes, I was working in a lot of different bars around Melbourne in the 2000s, and I can confirm that hearing Eurovision music was very common. The likes of Sirtab, Tattoo, Helena Paparizou were some of the favourites you could regularly hear around the town.
And with that growth, SBS were ready to have another crack at Australianising their coverage by sending our own commentators over to the contest.
One key player in making this happen was Paul Clark from production company Blink TV.
Yes, Paul came in with quite the CV. He had produced many music shows for TV such as Recovery, A Long Way to the Top, and Spicks and Specks, so he was well suited for the gig.
He shares how one phone call changed everything.
And we got a call from Denise Erickson, who was then head of television at SBS, and she said, I want to take two commentators to Eurovision. And I went, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. So I recommended Sam Pang and she recommended Julia Zemiro. I met them in London and took them across to Moscow. Australia was a complete oddity. And the fact that we were from the other side of the world was like, what are you doing here? They would just buy into the stupidity of it. So the producers and the EBU were fascinated that we were there. I think a lot of it came down to just how brilliant Julia was. They could see that we just really brought someone that was quite special. Now, no one from a network had ever tried to get backstage with a camera. And we had Sam Pang and Julia Zemiro. And Julia would just go shoulder to shoulder with these people. I've never seen anybody connect with artists as quickly as Julia in my life. Like, they just loved her from the first moment. And she was all heart. And Sam would go out of his way to ask some stupid question of someone like Rambo, you know, arguing that Rambo 3 was better than Rambo 1 because of blah, 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 blah. And they would just buy into the stupidity of it.
Now, what really stood out to me there, Dale, was things like, we were such an oddity. And the question, why are you even here? Gosh, some things never change, do they?
It seems Julia and Sam were a hit on the ground in Moscow, and that definitely translated back home. Here's Dr. Jess again.
They absolutely did reflect back the viewership, and in particular, it is crucial that they represent a kind of multicultural Australia and not just a European multicultural Australia. So when we think about Eurovision audiences and fans, again, we keep on harping back to there are European migrants in Australia and where most of us are descended from them. Not necessarily true in terms of most of us, because by the time we have Sam and Julia doing that commentary, Australia had changed quite drastically. And as I said earlier, it was never entirely successful in being white, despite, you know, the White Australia Policy's agenda. But what we certainly see from about the mid-1970s onwards is a racial diversification, and with that a cultural diversification of Australian migrants. And so when you look at Sam and Julia, they reflect that particular kind of Australian society, but they also reflect a kind of ochreness through Sam and a cosmopolitanness through Julia. So the combination of the two of them was something that no matter who you are, you could connect to in some way.
So, Mike, do you see yourself as the cosmopolitan one or the ochre one?
Well, I'm the multilingual stylish one and you're from North Queensland. Listeners can make of that what they will.
Well, you're probably actually a little bit of both. Anyway, there's no doubt Australia's first presence was a big success, but Paul saw this leading to even bigger things.
Alexander Rybak from Norway won that year, and we went to Oslo, and we went through the same thing. And I'm just thinking, this is something that we've got to be involved in. Like, we've got to get into this. At the same time, Mike Ebed came into the job as managing director of SBS. And I remember him writing to me and saying, oh, I'm going to Eurovision. I'll catch up with you over there. And I said to him, look, Mike, it's my dream that we actually get into this competition. Like, we should do it. He said, look, I've been thinking about the same thing. And so we began from our different positions to kind of navigate towards this. It was a very sort of gentle process of lobbying to begin with. And it meant that we had some bizarre lunches. Like, I'd get up at 4 a.m. in the morning in Azerbaijan and be at a lunch in Amsterdam to meet with their team and to kind of gradually gather the numbers. And Mike would say, we've got to go to this lunch in Belgium because the president of the EBU is there. And we'd go to this lunch and we'd kind of go, that wasn't the moment, was it? Like, he obviously isn't that important. But we gradually found our way to the people that were important. And one of them was Martin, who's now the head of Eurovision, Martin Osterdahl. And he was running Malmö. And he said to us in the lead up, can you just direct us a video about why Australia loves Eurovision? I said, oh, yeah, absolutely, we can. And so that was the first time we were actually in the show.
Let's have a little listen to some of that 2013 video.
Hello, bonjour, hey Europe, welcome to Australia. We've been watching Eurovision for 30 years now, and we want to show you just how much you've changed us. But you're so far away from us. Each year in Australia, we party by ourselves. But we still feel part of it. Many of us came from Europe, and Eurovision parties rock the nation every year. We just love being a part of your festival of song. Bring it on, Sweden.
I have to say, after years and years of watching, as a fan in Australia, it was really nice to be acknowledged. Oh, for sure, seeing Australia up on stage, even in video form, was just incredible. After all those years of watching, I couldn't believe that we were being made such a big deal of.
Now, so far, Dale, it sounds like it's all sunshine and lollipops from the production side of things.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like they were like, oh yeah, sure, Australia, you love the contest, you've got migration, fantastic, come on in.
Surely there's more to this.
Well, Dr. Jess might give us a different perspective on what might have been happening.
We need to be thinking the bigger picture at this point. The EBU always had plans for expansion. It is, even though it's focused on the European broadcasting area, it is a global network. And so the idea of taking this brand of Eurovision and being able to see where they could expand it to was incredibly appealing, particularly from a commercial perspective. So they had attempted to sell that brand, so to speak, or to license that brand to a production company in Singapore, if I recall correctly. That was never successful in getting an Asian Eurovision off the ground. So I think that what was happening was the EBU was looking for another avenue to still pursue that particular goal. And he had an audience that was already established, a broadcaster that was already quite invested in not just showing the program, but engaging with it in some way. So by extending some extra privileges to Australia, it was a way of building that relationship and starting to work on that project of Eurovision Asia, which we never came to see to fruition, but that was eventually announced officially as something that SBS and the EBU were working on together.
As I suspected, it sounds like there was a few factors at play here.
Look, there was definitely goodwill towards Australia and our connections to the contest, but I also think our geographical location didn't hurt for once.
And the next year, 2014, marked a real milestone for Australia.
Yeah, it was massive. Eurovision organisers invited us to perform as an interval act at the contest.
This is a massive deal. This is the first time we'd be performing live on stage.
How did this all come about? Let's hear from Paul.
We were being noticed. After Malmö, we went to Copenhagen and the Denmark team called me and said, we'd really like to do a moment with you. Come over and let's talk about it. So I met their creative team and they said, we don't want you to do a song. We want you to do something that really fucks up the whole show. And I went, okay, all right, no problem. We can do that. I was working with this wonderful entertainment head at the time called Katerina Denave in SBS. And we met with Jess Mauboy and with Louis Toole, who wrote a song called Sea of Flags. And we met with the guys from The Chaser, who wrote a song about us arriving, you know, just being incredibly stupid and belligerent as an opener. And then it would go to Jess Mauboy and sing the song. A sea of flags, so beautiful.
Now, first of all, let's talk about that presentation. If you haven't seen it, you've got to check it out. Personally, I've never gotten the dancing blowfly out of my mind.
Look, I love watching it now. At the time, there was a little bit of cultural cringe for me going on. But look, what a performance by Jess. It was a really proud moment. I completely remember being there in the living room watching that and just being so, so proud.
Yeah, just to see one of Australia's biggest stars on the Eurovision stage, it was absolutely incredible.
We certainly were making a big effort for an interval act, which did make it feel like it may be a rehearsal for something more to come. Here's Dr. Jess.
It was definitely a rehearsal run of competing. And there was a lot of investment into the idea of this performance where, you know, you had the choreographed act, you had the produced video, and then you had Jess Malboy's performance as well, which involved, you know, getting very well-known songwriters to work with her and to do all that wonderful staging and the gold dress and just everything. And it was also a very Eurovision song in terms of its style and its theme. So it was a way of expressing an understanding of what Eurovision was, saying that, hey, we as Australians, we get it and we love it and we want to be part of it. Can we?
On the next episode, Australia officially arrives at Eurovision
and we look at how that happened and how we got to stay.
And we'd like to invite you as a wild card.
How on earth could we be part of this? I'm all for it, but how can we be part of this?
And then we kept getting 12 points, kept having the camera facing us. It was like, what is happening?
So their expectation was we were going to win it.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Dale. This podcast was created by us for SBS Audio with additional mixing by Max Gosford. Catch all the action from Eurovision 2024 on SBS On Demand. Live streams, replays, official music videos, behind-the-scenes extras, and more.